This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Coming up, we've got all the news and views from Manchester City's week. It's your club, and this is your show.
Unbeaten in nearly 2 months and two last-minute goals away from a run of nine wins on the bounce, it feels like things are getting back to some sort of consistency for Manchester City. A word of warning, though, it was this week in the calendar 12 months ago that last season's horrible winter period started. But despite that, it does feel like this team is building towards something, gaining more of their identity back and drinking in the good vibes at the same time as well. Everton and Villarreal have been dispatched this week. We'll talk about those games shortly. And then there's perhaps a big test on the horizon with a trip to Villa Park coming up on Sunday. We'll hear from Frankie Maguire from All Villa No Filler later on to get his thoughts. Plus, we've got Swansea fans Sam and Alex on the show to preview the League Cup trip to South Wales. Also this week, what does it mean to be a City fan in 2025? We'll be getting into that question with Dom Farrell, whose new book charts the journey that supporters have been on from the bad old days of the late 90s to the good old days of more recent times. Plenty to discuss then with this week's guests. I'm David Mooney. With me, I've got City fan Richard Burns.
Hi David, how are you doing?
Not too bad, thank you. And we've got commentator for the Premier League, Five Live, Match of the Day, and plenty of others, Connor McNamara. Hi, Connor.
Hey, Dave. Nice to be here. Cheers.
How are things?
Very good, very good. I've had a good week, and I'm looking forward to going to Villa Park on Sunday to commentate on City, so this all feels part of my prep.
Excellent. You're doing the game, which is it's going to be a fascinating one. We will get to that later on. But first, I know we have a little bit of a pithy question to start with. Richard, I'm delegating that to Instagram this week because Syak got in touch to say, after seeing Bernardo's header against Villarreal, what are your most memorable headed goals by City players? What are you having?
So there were two that sprang immediately to mind, both of which I didn't get to see live.
There was great start to an anecdote.
Yeah. So I'll go for my second favourite first, De Bruyne away at Brighton. I think did the score it? I think it was a pretty comprehensive win. Maybe 4-0, memory affected by not having seen it live, I think. But a fairly routine win on the run into winning a title. And my favourite...
Can we just say, like, Kevin De Bruyne scored a diving header there, which is worth pointing out because, like he wasn't known for his heading.
Yeah, of the many, many skills that Kevin De Bruyne was renowned for, it was not one that you would list chief amongst them, was it? So no, it's a surprising goal and a brilliant one. Maybe a player more renowned for heading though. My very favourite City header. Edin Dzeko versus Tottenham in 5-1 win at White Hart Lane pretty early in the 2011-2012 season. And a brief anecdote, if you'll indulge me on, as to how I never saw this live. So the reason I didn't see it live was simple. I was at a christening, but we'd made every effort to, and it was, you know, slightly easier to avoid scores then, you know, there wasn't as much chance of somebody in the room was streaming it. Which obviously nobody would be disrespectful into it, Christine anyway. And so we'd recorded it. I think the game was on ESPN and my dad had set the recorder for it. We were avoiding the score. I thought, just watch it as live when I get home. And long story short, we did end up getting the score ruined for us, but obviously it was a 5-1 win, Edin Dzeko hat-trick. And we thought, well, we'll still watch it when we get in anyway. It sort of sounds like a game worth catching up on. When we got home, my dad had hit the... either the entry above it or below it on the ESPN list and accidentally recorded Kaiserslautern. So I never, ever got the benefit of that game.
But was Kaiserslautern a good game? Was that one?
Didn't watch it. Didn't bother. Didn't have the Edin Dzeko header in it. Yeah. But yeah, I think the masterfulness of that header, it sort of comes in, not a bad cross, but it sort of comes in behind him. And he sort of cranes his neck and almost hooks the header.
When does a header leave a keeper standing?
It was just absolutely flawless technique. When Dzeko was really at the start of really settling and getting going as a goal scorer for City, he'd obviously had a difficult start. So that was he had a great game and a bit of a sign of things to come from him.
Yeah, can I chuck in a third one that I know you missed because we've talked about it on the podcast before? Micah Richards at Villa Park in the last minute of the FA Cup. Where you sat on the remote and turned the telly off?
Yeah, jump forward, remote was on the floor, jump forward to the edge of the settee, stood on the remote, turned it off, turned it back on, and he was celebrating. Yeah.
Was that the famous expletive-ridden interview?
Oh, yes. The one. Yeah, those were the days. Connor, come on. I know you're not a City fan, so I know it's not necessarily easy to drip in there and dip into the history of great headers. But any spring to mind?
Yeah, I mean, my first instinct was to think back to the Niall Quinn days, the Irish connection. He obviously got loads of good headers, but actually difficult to just pick one sort of standout one. I presume you won't give me, because I to me, this is what should have been a header, is the Balotelli shoulder, you know, that the absolute petulance. I'm not going to nod it in, I'm going to shoulder it in. But look, for me, if I was to say most memorable Manchester City headed goal, I would say Vincent Kompany, that was a 2012 Manchester derby. And that was the turning point. That was, you know, Manchester United for years had bullied City, and it's fine. You might have some money now. You might, you know, be stringing a few results together, but we will boss you. We are still the big brother. And with one leap, you know, and from memory, I'm going to absolutely throw myself out to dry here, but was it in the first half? It was early enough in the game from memory.
Yeah, stoppage it was time, like a first late half.
Yeah, first half. So it was kind of, you know, those days are over. You ain't bullying us anymore. And he just muscled, you know, a classic Kompany moment. Great celebration, the way I can remember it all. That's why I wasn't even commentating the game, but I remember that so clearly, the jump and the leap and the celebrate. So, that felt an era-defining moment for Manchester City for me.
Yeah, well, I know Niall from Retro City Goals will listen to this, and if I don't shout out Antoine Sibierski against Leeds in 2004, then he's going to have my guts for garters. So, Niall, I've done my duty there. That's your favourite. Let's go then to the games with Everton and Villarreal. And Connor, I don't think we can really discuss this week without focusing really on Erling Haaland. Mm. 14 games he's played this season. He scored in 13 of them. He's played roughly 1,166 minutes of football this season, scored 24. That's a goal roughly every 49 minutes. That is ridiculous.
Yeah, the definition of the word ridiculous, it gets bent out of shape so much when we talk about this guy, and he just continues to do it. I do my notes, I have a little section for each player, and I've had to go on to a second section this week because there's just so many things. You know, if he scores, he becomes the first City player to score in 11 consecutive games. There was a guy whose name you guys might know, but back in the 50s, who's 10 in a row. So no one's ever scored in 11 games in a row for City. So that's a chance for Erling Haaland. There's an attitude, there's a mood shift about him. I was at the Club World Cup in the summer. I remember the night that they went out, the game they lost in, he was taken off as a sub. He played okay and he was taken off in the heat and all that. And I remember being surprised how animated, how much he wanted to win that. And that was around the time when it was announced, this new sort of captain's group of players that Pep had nominated him to be one of the group of captains for the squad. And I remember thinking, you know, he really wanted to go through. It wasn't like, oh, I can just go off my holidays now, we're getting knocked out. He was, you know, really animated as much as any fan on the bench. And it really sort of struck me as this is a guy who wants to go on and achieve now. The whole point, come to City, win the Champions League. That was always the plan. Last season wasn't the plan. And I think he's got very high, very exacting standards. I know he signed the new contract, so it's not like he wants to go away. He's like, I'm here, I want to become legend for this club. And I think his body language, his maturity this season, and I think we look at people like Isak tried to settle in at Liverpool. You look at the Šeško at Manchester United, you look at Gyökeres at Arsenal. These are strikers who've committed, who've been successful elsewhere, but they're kind of waiting for their teammates to find the passes that they want to get onto. And I think Haaland, over his career, has been so mature, his Manchester City career, to adapt his game. It's not coming in to say, I'm the goal machine, you do what, you know, everything's got to match me. I think he's been so effective at, and it has taken time, but he is now a fully functioning part of the Pep machine. And it's the work rate, it's what he does around the halfway line, laying it off to others, and then using that power and pace to accelerate. I think the goal was it against Arsenal was a great illustration of that. And that is a goal I don't think he would have scored two seasons ago in terms of that thrust. So obviously always had the talent, but an even more dangerous player now because he's not just an individual in a team, he's an important cog in the Pep Guardiola machine.
Yeah, and Richard, I mean, the other side of this as well is in his first season with Haaland, I remember talking to you about how we got really giddy when he was going through on goal because it just felt like he was going to score at all times. That kind of went away a little bit in his second season and last season. That is so, it's so back, isn't it?
Yeah, massively, which is funny to say given that he's missing chances. He had I joked with the guy next to me at the Everton game when he grumbled about there being 7 minutes stoppage time because he wanted to get off. And I said, it's time for a hat trick. And then as it happened, Haaland had a hat trick of chances in stoppage time alone, none of which, two of which he should have scored. One was much harder.
Which one was the hard one in your view?
Going around the keeper. Yeah. I think he had to take it wide, and that meant that narrows the angle, doesn't it? So, I mean, it is beginning to have that inevitable feel about it again. And certainly going into a game, it has that inevitable feel that he's going to score. And it's back to that feeling of almost having a goal in the bank before we play. And it's, I think the thing that is so encouraging at the moment, and I sort of caveat this with, I think there's only so far this can ever go because of the type of player he is. But there's much more all-round contribution from him as well. It's not just that he's... And even to say he's back scoring, he still scored a ton of goals last season. It just looked, you know, by most players' standards. But everybody could see that he wasn't at his best. And clearly, he wasn't as lethal. Now he looks lethal again. The record, I mean, you said it yourself, but I laughed out loud, like when you sent the screen grab the other day. And so like this, these are the kind of things, like if you're playing a computer game and you had a striker posting those numbers, you'd quit because it was too easy. Like it'd be unrealistic. It's just, it's almost like make-believe numbers. But there is some more in his all-round game now. His defending, his defensive contribution is much better. I think there are signs that his link-up play is getting better, and he's definitely, he's just grasped that role of being a leader properly. And I think you and Sam Lee spoke a lot in the summer about the purpose of making him a captain and putting him in that group was to not necessarily reward him for his leadership, but to bring the leadership out of him. I hope I'm not mischaracterizing your 2 points. And I think we're really seeing that. And I've always said with Haaland, like he wears his stardom very lightly and like never more so than at the moment, where he's just loving being the main man, isn't he? And it's just flying. It's fantastic to see.
I'd say a word of caution, only because this is so glowing that, you know, I'd be disappointed if he doesn't get a hat trick. He's not scored his last 3 games against Villa. I thought that was interesting. He's only ever scored 1 goal against them. So maybe there's something in that Tyrone Mings, Ezri Konsa sort of axis that's able to outmuscle him or keep an eye on him. But, you know, maybe just because he scores with ease against so many opponents, it's interesting, the one or two that he sometimes has an issue with.
That was at Villa Park, that goal, though. So
correct, it was at Villa Park,
Omen's
yeah.
There, so, yeah, we'll see.
3 years ago, long time ago.
Yeah. I mean, the other side of this, Connor, as well, is thank goodness for City that Haaland is scoring, because nobody else is right now.
Yeah, is it 8 of the last 9, something like that, goals that City have scored in all competitions have been scored for? Like, look, it's a first world problem. You know, when you're scoring 1.4 goals a game, whatever he's doing, it kind of doesn't matter if no one else is. But yeah, look, traditionally over the years, City don't want to rely on just one striker. And, you know, I think over the years, the threat, the Haaland years I'm talking about, the threat has always been if you put 2 or 3 defenders on him, well, then you're just creating space for one of the other, you know, Foden or whoever to nip in. So definitely Pep Guardiola will want to see those figures increased. But no, look, he's taking his chances. The body language is good. He's playing with a smile on his face. I think it bodes really, really well.
Richard, are you going to be subscribing to his new YouTube channel?
Well, I've just been told that all that's on it so far is him frying eggs. So I don't subscribe to many YouTube channels. My hope is that that's going to be City's official outlet for announcing the outcome of the charges, but the Premier League probably won't be up for that, will they? So it might be a bit too.
You can't bake a cake without breaking a few eggs.
Yeah, yeah. That's. I mean, to be honest with you, Richard, like fried eggs sounds right up your street. Isn't your signature dish like fried egg and chips? And
I've progressed a little bit. I can do different kinds of eggs, like a cracking omelette, scramble a good egg. I've moved on from just fried egg and chips.
Excellent.
It's a long time ago. Better than me.
Still
a great meal.
Richard, just on the goals from other parts of the team, you take the games against Everton and Villarreal. Now, Savinho scuffed 3 shots at the keeper over the course of those games. Doku missed from close range against Everton when really should probably be doing more to test Pickford at the very least, let alone putting it in the net. The 3 of them, Haaland, Savinho and Doku, combined to miss a glorious chance in the first 30 seconds at Villarreal. Like, as much as they are missing those chances are there. So it shouldn't take too much, should it?
Well, no, it shouldn't. And it's always that, there's two sides of the coin, aren't there? You have to be encouraged by the chance creation because it's that signs of City approaching their best again. Not absolute classic City, but making high quality chances over and over again. But I would say that the reason those chances are being missed is because they're being given to players who aren't natural goal scorers and have a long way to go to become that. So if those chances were being missed, like seasons gone by, and this is probably already becoming a pretty well-worn conversation, if we were in a spell like this in the treble season, for example, or any of the seasons, the four in a row seasons, then you'd okay, Mahrez is missing a few chances. The goals are going to come. Sterling's missing. I mean, Sterling, God love him, missed plenty of chances, but he racked up a fair few as well. And we just don't have, between Savinho and Doku, we don't have that record to say, actually, we can see this is a dip and that the goals are going to come. At the moment, for those two players in particular, the scuff chances and not being very effective once they're into the box is kind of par for the course, which I think is that's the glass half empty side of it. And that's not to say that they can't improve, because, you flip that again and say, well, if you've got two players who are this good and this skillful, and, I'm something of a Savinho skeptic, but he's had a good week overall contribution wise, I have to say. The ceiling and the chance for improvement is absolutely enormous. And so if they do become clinical, then that's an enormous amount of goals waiting to be unlocked. But at the moment, I just don't think you can say, well, they missed them against Everton and Villarreal, but come Villa, they'll be ready to put those in. Like there's a way to go yet before those players are really adding that contribution. But then they're not the only two other players, Foden, Bernardo, we've got Shirky to come in. I think Reinders had a reasonable goal scoring season last year at Milan. There should still be goals on the pitch, but in terms of out forward players, Savinho and Doku do this. There's a contribution is improving, but goals they need to come, and it's a lot of work to get there.
Connor, do you reckon there is an element of it's almost like you can't win either way with City at the minute, because either they're too reliant on Haaland and everything is going through him, or they're a team that can't work out how to have Haaland in it because they don't have the same passing ability and the same ability to dominate games when he's there than when he's not. That always used to be the old argument. Is it just a case that right now maybe City are just geared up to creating chances for Haaland? And if there ever came a time when he wasn't there, if he was injured, suspended, whatever, then the rest of the team then just has to get on with it and step up themselves.
Yeah, I do think it's an interesting one. And look, I don't have the data, I don't have the stats in terms of are the majority of chances only falling for Haaland? I mean, it feels to me the games I've seen this season, Foden doing his usual thing that he's always done his career, gets at edge of the area, drops his shoulder, then tries to bend it. It feels like there's been a lot of those, and then the shot either gets blocked or it's off target. In terms of how you tactically set up a team, I mean, there's no those shots going into the top corner just being a sweeter strike. It's not how the team was set up that made them be blocked or made them go off target. So it feels to me like Doku gets a few shots away. Obviously, he's primarily in there to provide crosses. Again, I mean, I heard you saying there, but being a bit of a skeptic about Savinho, I feel a little bit like that. He's a player I really want to like. I kind of love the pace, love the directness. But he's one of the, and I've had a few of these in my career as a commentator where, and famously for me, Zlatan Ibrahimovic was one where I knew he was a great player and I'd seen the YouTube highlight reels, but man, you wouldn't see him week in, week out, but a handful of occasions for years when I saw him, he never really did anything. And I was thinking I know this guy's good, but I haven't seen it. And I feel a bit like that with Savinho, that all the ingredients are there, but the end product isn't quite. I was at Huddersfield the night that he scored the one goal he's got this season in the League Cup. I think he's had a couple of assists the last two games, but I feel that he needs to start producing just a few more shooting positions, but maybe he's very specifically been told what he has to try and do. And if enough of them fall in the end for Erling Haaland, then I don't think Pep Guardiola is going to be too disappointed. But, think back over the years, people like, Reinders, he scored quite early on, didn't he? And then I think he hasn't goal in a few assists in the last few games. And maybe that's to do with Rodri either being injured or not available, that he's had to play a little bit deeper, even if he isn't with Gonzalez or whatever. So maybe, again, you'd have to look at the heat maps, but to see, is he getting forward as much as he was in those opening games? And you know, I'm thinking back to the likes of Kovacic, which always drill one in, wouldn't he? I mean, there's kind of random goals from midfield that just don't seem to be there this season. But still, I don't, you know, this is a problem if City are losing games or are not being able to produce late winners or whatnot. The fact they're scoring the goals, they've established the leads, not chasing games late on, I think that's a mitigating circumstance to maybe why they haven't been shared around a bit more.
Yeah, and just briefly as well, Richard, because Connor's said something there that is, I think, really key. You know, roughly in terms of minutes-wise, 4.5 of the last 9 games, the unbeaten 9 games, they've done it without Rodri in the team. And last season, when Rodri wasn't there, like, the house of cards came falling down.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely enormous for City to be able to win without him, because it used to be prior to last season. I mean, it was almost literally, although you can search for many reasons why, the very basic facts were pretty much if Rodri played, City didn't get beat. And if Rodri didn't play, City got beat. Like, it did fall that way. Obviously, last season, that's a different picture because he missed the whole season pretty much, but City had a bad season. There was much more to that than Rodri's injury, much, much more. But now, to know that he is an option again, obviously not all the time, because clearly there's, I guess, some toll on his body and there's plenty of work to do to get him back to, if he can even get back to 100% of what he was, there's still a journey for him to go on there. Clearly, if you have a version of Rodri available, then that makes you a better team. But to have learned a way to win without him, whether that means being absolutely brilliant and winning without him, or sometimes not being so brilliant and still getting it done, it's still an improvement on how it used to be without him. And I think a lot of credit there has to go to some improvement in Nico Gonzalez, who went from, you know, last season being...
disappeared from February.
Yeah, well, he had the mini Rodri game against Newcastle, and then everything seemed to go, I mean, he did, like, he disappeared, didn't he? And then to, which I think were clearly not true rumours, but believable rumours in the summer that he might have been straight back off again. And again, I mean, he's far from perfect, but he's definitely stepping up at the moment. And I think, to me, he's just looking more confident in the role, and he looks a bit more sure of himself and maybe sure of what his instructions are. I'll always say, when we get to these points, I'm no great tactical analyst, but in terms of the basic eye test, he just looks more comfortable on the ball. And I feel like I can watch him and say that his teammates are somewhat more comfortable giving him a bit of responsibility on the ball and trusting him. And, you know, a talented, happy player is a pretty good thing to have. And he's looking that way at the moment. And I think certainly any concerns that he wasn't going to be able to do the job there are dissipating. And then you have to accept that Rodri's the best in his position in the world. He's one of the best to have ever played that position. He got injured at the point where he was accepted as the best player in the world, you know, whatever you think of the Ballon d'Or. And so you're not going to get a direct replacement for that, because if you could, then Rodri wouldn't be the value that he is if you could just have someone yeah, to step in and do that job. But to have someone who can come in and do a version of that job pretty capably is a handy thing to have, and Nico's getting there, definitely.
This is a paid promotion for NordVPN. Now, we have opposition fans on the podcast all the time. Later in today's episode, we'll hear from Frankie from All Villa No Filler and from the Swansea fans Alex and Sam. But sometimes, when I ask supporters of upcoming opponents if they'll come on, the only time that they can record is a time when I can't be at home, and sometimes I've had to find a quiet spot and hop on some public Wi-Fi to record. When I do that, I use NordVPN to make sure that my connection is both private and safe. It's easy to use. I just open NordVPN on my laptop and pick one of more than 8,300 servers across 126 different countries. I've got NordVPN on my laptop and my phone. You only need one account to use it on up to 10 devices, and it supports every major platform. I use it on macOS and iOS because I'm an Apple user, but you can also use it on Windows, Android, Linux, and even your Android TV if you've got one of those. So if you're heading over to one of City's remaining Champions League away games, they go to Spain to play Real Madrid in December and Norway to play Bodo Glimt in January, then you can use NordVPN to keep your data safe if you're using Wi-Fi in a hotel, in a cafe, or in the airport. It also means that you can switch your virtual location back to the UK so that you don't miss out on any subscriptions that you might have that would otherwise be going to waste. If you're staying at home though and you're not going to those Champions League games, you can still use NordVPN to access content from overseas, or you can protect your whole household. You can block ads, scan files that you download, and avoid malicious links. To get the best discount off your NordVPN plan, go to nordvpn.com/bluemoon. Our link will also give you 4 extra months on the 2-year plan. There's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. The link is in the podcast episode description as well.
Ad-free episodes are available on Patreon. Sign up at patreon.com/bluemoonpodcast.
I want to get into this. What does it mean to be a City fan in 2025? It's a club where the best ever period is happening while its worst ever period is within living memory for a high proportion of the fans. Supporters used to be admired for the commitment to the cause, turning up week after week while performances and results got worse and worse. But now it's all plastic fans and where were you when you were shit? It's a world where many of the sports ills are laid at the club's door, whether it's state ownership, sports washing, 115 charges, how can we possibly compete with this and all of that? In the middle of it all, you've got City fans being pulled from pillar to post. Journalist and City fan Dom Farrell, a regular guest on the podcast, has written all about this in his new book, Glory Days for the Waifs and Strays. I've been speaking to him about the complexities, or not, of being a modern City fan.
A lot of it focuses on the identity that was... I don't think it wasn't an identity that was established at Wembley 99, because you have all the build-up to that, of the all the managers in one season... getting relegated, keeping the ball on the corner flag. Joe Royle had coined City-itis, I think, before. You know, he certainly had coined City-itis before the Gillingham game. I mean, I guess that the long build-up to Wembley 99 really starts, and you know, I only touch on this like to mention and know more because I wasn't there. But it really starts with Peter Swales bringing Malcolm Allison back. And that's, I mean, that's there's a sort of almost a Greek tragedy sort of thing about it of... Malcolm Allison was, you know, in terms of being a coaching visionary, was almost like the Guardiola of his day with his coaching ideas. The first time he was there with Joe Mercer. Mm. But you bring him back on his own. It was like, you know, the king has returned and, oh God, the king has set everything on fire. And obviously there were bits after that, like there's the early 90s under Peter Reid, like finishing fifth a couple of times. It wasn't all bad, but it was definitely the trajectory changed then. And it culminates in this crazy day when they are scrapping to get out of a division they were supposed to waltz to. So it does mention in the book, there's a chapter about the United rivalry. And I do think that that is also an important part of it. That at that time, the Gillingham game was a few days after they won the treble. One thing I thought in the stand at Wembley that day is like, there is no way that City come back from this because United did it in midweek. And of course, that has no bearing on anything, but you know the logic the football fans go through. It's like, we won't do it because they did it. Because they always do it and we never fucking do.
I want to kind of touch into that because that kind of builds on your overall point for the whole book about what the identity of a City fan is. Because, like, what is a football club to begin with? Like if you were to define what a football club is it the players? Is it the staff? Is it the institution? Is it the actual business? Or is it the fans? Or is it all of that?
It's all of them. It's all of them, all and the way they intersect. And it'll vary from person to person, but how strongly that identity was forged or baked in at Wembley 99, and like that's still going on. And obviously, you then have the decade after with all the mayhem of Taksin and all the hope of Sven at the same time, David James up front. That element of farce that sort of stayed with it. And then obviously things change beyond all recognition with the takeover. But there were a few points when I thought about writing this book and played around with the idea. The moment that sort of crystallised it for me to think the idea of what is left, what threads go through, was on the weekend of the Champions League final in Istanbul, when I ended up on Navizade Street the night before the final, just having a couple of beers and just hanging out with some people and just seeing just all the absolute unbridled joy there of So many people hugging, so many people crying, so much singing the night before the final. And it struck me that the vast majority of people I saw there, I remember thinking that night, they will have been at Gillingham. And if they weren't, if there were some people who were a bit too young for that, they would have been bored to tears about it from a relative, from mates. And it was like, the history feels really close at hand tonight. At a point where really, if you think they're going into that final with Pep Guardiola in the dugout, Erling Haaland up front, £100 million Jack Grealish on the wing, Kevin De Bruyne, maybe the best player the Premier League's ever seen in midfield. They should be so far away from that, but the history felt massively close at hand that night, like it was the end of a journey. So yeah, to answer your question, what is a football club? Going off that romantic reading of it, I guess it is the people, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's I'm interested in your kind of you leave no stone unturned in the book, in the sense of like the issues that surround City. And I mean, 115 has become shorthand for pretty much everything wrong with football, yeah, and with City. But it is like 115 is a different issue to human rights in Abu Dhabi, is a different issue to ticket prices and to all these sorts of these issues that fans have to grapple with. And like you do attack it from all of these angles, and you do examine that relationship with from all of these angles. And I'm kind of interested what your did your feelings as a fan change on the basis of what people were telling you, on the basis of how people were interacting with their club? Because like ultimately, those City fans that were at Gillingham and were in Istanbul and kind of enjoyed the journey in different times, like they are the same people and they have the same feelings towards the football club. But is the football club now a different entity because of the ownership, because of the charges, because of everything else that comes with it?
I think ultimately no, because those people still do have the same feelings, because you still have that thread of people who just go to the match to watch their team, as they always did, as they always will. There was one chapter in the book where I spoke to some people who have fallen away from it. One fan who has entirely, for various reasons that I thought were really interesting, because it wasn't just, again, to back up the thing that it's never just one big thing around a football club. There's so many different threads that build up your feeling towards them. Who'd like... just absolutely was just had cut it off. And then there's a journalist I speak to who's a City fan who, and yeah, it does complicate your feelings for the club a little bit when you're working at it, but I think he feels a lot more conflicted than I do. KC, you know, of this parish, was saying that one of the lines in the book that when I was looking at transcripts, that really stood out to me. He said he was someone who, and I hope he doesn't mind me saying, he's someone who has decided like not to have an active relationship with his father. But it's different with a football club somehow. And that was like, I found that striking. But yeah, it's a powerful thing when it's, if you strip it down to its most basic stuff, it's a massive, massive group of people from various different backgrounds. In those moments within a football match, they all want one thing to happen. The team in blue to kick the ball in the goal more than anything else. It's just, that's as simple and base as it is, but that's a seriously powerful thing. To experience something collectively. So can you say it's the same club on the basis of that? I sort of think you can, because it's the same people, or if it's not the same people, it's the descendants of those people still wanting the team with that badge that, yeah, sometimes has a power on it, sometimes doesn't, to score the goal.
Do you think, like, of the fans that you spoke to, do they have to rationalise? I mean, there was a quote in the book from Gary Cook from around the time of the takeover, where he said, if you're developing your nation and you're looking to be on the global stage, we are your proxy brand for a nation, which like immediately screams very, very problematic in terms of what an ownership can of a football club can be. But as you say, all these collection of people just want the guys in blue to kick it in the goal, whether or not Sheikh Mansour is the owner or whether or not Peter Swales is the owner.
Yeah, I should say that isn't a quote that I was given from Gary Cook. That's from a book called The Game about the development of the Premier League by Joshua Robinson and... I've forgotten the other guy that wrote it. This is a good promo for them. Anyway, it's not my quote, and I've tried to attribute it as best I can. But yeah, that is something Gary Cook said, and that is one of those phrases, that's one of those quotes like the email of, we would rather hire the best lawyers in the world for 50 years and sue them, blah, 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 that gets trotted out as like, look at how bad this is. On the other hand, that was Gary Cook doing a sales pitch to people from Abu Dhabi.
At a time when the club was on its arse.
Yeah, the club was like, you know, John Wardle was paying the wages again. Taxim was in hiding with frozen assets. It was mentally they needed somebody to keep the wheels turning. So listen, if you look at all the adverts around the stadium now, you look at all the superb bits of acting that Pep does in Etihad Airways adverts. Maybe it is a proxy brand.
Does that matter though? Does that, if, like, to the average fan going to the ground wanting the team to win, does that matter? Because whether City are a proxy brand for Abu Dhabi and everything that comes with it, and they're winning trophy after trophy, or whether they're battling to get out of the third tier, like, the people are still the same people.
I don't know if it does. And this isn't me passing the book saying that is something that's absolutely cool and great, but there is so much of this stuff and you choose what you engage with, and going and wanting the team to win is a constant. If people have big problems with City's owners, what do you want City fans to do about it, really? If football fans got to choose who their owners were, Mike Ashley would not have been at Newcastle for 13 years. Just wouldn't have been. But he was. You don't get to choose that. But you do get to choose whether it's a great idea to have a Manchester Thanks You Sheikh Mansour banner up in your ground. You might be fair game to be criticised for that. But at the same time, you can also choose to engage, and this is where the example of the work that the Food Bank Group do, of it's their community club that they've gone to all their lives with their mates. It's what they do of a Saturday. City now, because of their ownership, because of their success, has a bigger platform. And you're going to engage with that and use that platform, use it as a megaphone to try and help some of the most vulnerable people around. And then because you've established those networks as like a more active, engaged bit of the fan base, they were able to lead the ticketing protests. And, you know, to Manchester City's owners, the fact that there isn't disabled parking charges is like what would have been about 40 grand over the course of a season. It's nothing to them. But to those people that had those charges waived, and I know the club claimed that it was always going to be on a trial basis, blah, blah, blah. But the fans just made sure, just in case, that those charges wouldn't be there. That's like an unbelievable help to some of the most vulnerable parts of the fan base. Same thing with ticket prices being frozen and match day ticket prices going down and other bits of ticketing policy that they're trying to hold the club's feet to the fire on, because that community and that, you know, that thing of that thread, I'm sort of claiming the grandiose way, are the club more than anybody else. You've got to make sure they're still able to go. So when I see that, and then I also see some of the things about the idea that City fans are just sort of lickspittle, happy clappy, you know, your shills for an ownership that is a dreadful thing for football. It's like, okay, I don't get annoyed at that in and of itself, because I think if you were outside the club, I think always a good test is like, if another club, say, had City's ownership and we didn't, what would I think? Ultimately, you don't know. But I do understand why, if you were not in the weeds of Manchester City every day, you might jump to those conclusions about the oil club empty had 115 mob being like just a boilerplate to say they're all the game's problems. So I see why people would have those thoughts, but I see the other side of it, and I see that human side of it. And I just think an awful lot, sometimes in good faith, sometimes not, gets bolted onto the modern Manchester City, whether it's whether the fans are enjoying winning trophies enough, do they even like winning anymore and all that, or whether it's people don't like how football in England is played anymore, whose fault's that? Pep Guardiola, well, you know, and it's all of these things just get thrown on. So I just wanted to sort of unpick what is it like for the people who are actually involved in that, who support that, who go and watch that, who have played for that, who know the guys that manage it, who are engaged in the community around it. I kind of just wanted to put that sort of humanity around Manchester City, which is around every single football club, that can maybe get lost a little bit. I sort of wanted to put that out there in its various forms.
A quick question from Steve on the emails. I'm going to do a listener question in an interview. This is proper meta stuff now. Steve got in touch to say, I was thinking about how well-liked, albeit in a pitying way, City once were back in our serial underperforming years while United were ruling the roost. Even the Aguero moment was celebrated across the nation, not least by the QPR fans sat just in front of where I was at the far end.
Well, don't tell Wayne Rooney that. Whoa, that never happened.
But at some point thereafter, our popularity among football fans not only waned, but plummeted to our now much-loathed status, something I've taken all the more delight in with every trophy we bagged and thus shoved down the throats of our detractors. But I never really focused on when this national change of mind and heart occurred. I just know it felt to me like a cliff edge rather than a gradual thing. When did this happen? Was it after our Centurion season, after our second, third, fourth, etc. titles, or what? And I'm interested in this because, Dom, do City fans want to be loved?
Right. So I think they do. I think that an awful lot of how City fans react to certain elements of coverage goes back to that thing of, we used to like us. But as Steve says in the question there, he's someone that's got like right into the sort of the yes, sicko's gift type person. Like, yeah, he hates me. Yeah, nice. Yeah, yeah. So I put this suggestion to the vast majority of people I spoke to in terms of fans. And the initial thing was for most people to reject it and go, well, yeah, it was nice being liked, but it wasn't nice being shit. I much prefer, again, it goes back to that thing of you just want to go and watch the team in the blue shirt kick the ball in the goal and win. And that happens loads more often now. Some people prefer this. Nevertheless, I do think there is an element of it was nice being everyone's second favourite team and all the goodwill around Gillingham. And Steve's very right to bring that up, the Aguero moment, that was like a massive sweet spot of they were slaying the dragon. They were beating Ferguson's United in the most incredibly cinematic way possible. City fans got a little bit of an extra run of being the, you know, oh, we like them, they're all right. If, say, for example, a hated, adored, never ignored Man United fan or an It Means More Liverpool fan or a North London Forever Arsenal fan, whatever, they'll see that and go, oh, yeah, it doesn't matter, does it? We're the Arsenal. Whereas I think there's an element with City fans that they will go, what Steve said, go, oh, yeah, fuck them. But there'll also be an element of, you used to like us, why are you being mean? There's just a little, there's that little emotional reaction that's just there, that little spark. And then after that, that spark might drive you into, right, well, this is all an agenda and they're all crooked and all the rest of it. But I do think City fans like being liked, which is normal. And I do think that adjustment, there is an element of like from Liverpool United fans when they get sticked from outside of their bubble of like, we don't give a fuck. We are Liverpool. Mm. We are Man United. I think it's okay to acknowledge that City fans did give a fuck for a long time because being liked was kind of all we had. And you can't just turn that off. But yeah, obviously people are hardening on it as the years go on. In terms of before and after, I do think Guardiola makes a difference because it's that Arsene Wenger thing about some teams have money, some teams have ideas, they have money and ideas. When Guardiola came, that was that then.
Yeah.
It was all there. And not only did he win with it, he won with 100 points. He then won with 98 points and the treble, beating a much admired and loved Liverpool team. If there is a before and after moment to pick out, and I do mention this in the book, it's probably that FA Cup final against Watford.
Yeah, well, Dom, there's so much more in the book that I could chat to you about. Honestly, I think it's a brilliant read. I read it. I said to you when we did the interview on Let Me Talk. I read the whole thing across about 3 days just because I couldn't put it down. And like, honestly, it's such a fascinating topic, the fan journey from the shitness to the goodness. And I think you've done a wonderful job with it. So congratulations on it. Where can people get it? If people listen to this are thinking, I want to go and get a copy of that right now, where would you send them?
I've scribbled on a few copies in Waterstones on Deansgate. If you want to do the old-fashioned way and go and buy a book from a shop. Other than that, all the normal online places, we will also have some copies on sale at the launch party at the Waldorf, which is next Thursday, the 30th of October, 7:30, upstairs room, where David will be having a chat to me about the book if you've not had enough of that already.
Don't worry, I've got plenty of other things to ask you, don't worry.
And by the way, if anyone has listened to me doing this on City Ramble, 9320, Noisy Neighbours and Let Me Talk, God bless you.
If you enjoy the show, please give it a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts.
That was Dom Farrell. There is a longer chat with Dom on the Blue Moon Podcast Patreon feed right now. That episode is completely free for anybody that would like to listen to it. So head on over to members.bluemoonpodcast.com for more information on how to do it. Richard, Dom has spoken very well there. And I know that we always say that all football fans are broadly the same. But there is something unique about City fans' experience compared to others, given the closeness of the best and worst periods in the club's history.
Yeah, I think so. I think there is, like, you know, any fan can claim to have a unique experience with their club, but the journey that City have been on and the way that it's come about, I do think is pretty unique. I think I sort of think City are a bit of a sliding doors club because without the takeover, then so much of what has followed, like, doesn't happen. The Premier League doesn't have its Aguero moment. And of course, the Premier League has many iconic moments. It's not all resting on Aguero. However, that is one of the most marketable moments in Premier League history. It's iconic. It doesn't have Pep Guardiola coming to City, winning four in a row, rewriting all of the record books. It doesn't have Haaland coming to City and rewriting all the goal-scoring records that we've been talking about here.
It doesn't have 1-1-5.
Exactly. It doesn't have, and all of the stuff that has brought with it, and all of the murkiness that comes with City. And as a fan, I'll be careful how I say this, because there's no one right way to deal with all that stuff. But I think the only honest way to deal with it is to accept and understand that wherever you draw the line on what you can accept your club being involved in, and I say that as somebody who doesn't particularly like our Romas, but I still have my season ticket. I still go. I still give my money over. I still watch every game that I can. And I still love the team. And I wouldn't trade any of the success that has come with all of this. But you have to, I think you have to acknowledge that at least some of what City do isn't good for football. And then you have to choose whether you care about that or not. So, you know, multi-club ownership is another one of mine. I could not care less about any of the other clubs involved in the City Football Group. I mean, I would say I almost actively dislike them through the attempt to force an association, and like the assumption that I've had from other football fans that I might in some way care about that, when I think misses the point of what I care about City. You know, it's in the connection that you have when, as I came to football, I followed City as my dad's team, who, you know, watched them as a boy, and then we started going together with my sister. And that's something that I've now passed on to my own son. Couldn't care less about New York City, a startup club who just so happened to play in blue because of our owners happened to own them, you know, through the City Group own them. But there's loads of murkiness that comes along with it. And from Dom's interview, and I had the great pleasure of being one of the people who, I have no idea if I made it in, but
I've read the book here and there, yeah.
Excellent. But of speaking to Dom when he was writing this book, you can tell from that interview, Dom's the perfect person to capture all of this and get across all those different and disparate experiences across like people's relationship with the club, across different demographics and age groups, because it's not just unique as a fan base. It then becomes unique for every single person. When you think of younger fans who will never have seen a relegation or even have seen City outside of the Champions League, but will have people like us, not that much older than them, reminding, you know, saying, you don't know how good you've got it. And like, they'll be very familiar with Gillingham. They'll be very familiar with the York away cliches and the fans on the hill at Blackburn, but they didn't live it. But then you've got this group of fans who, like us, who we've taken in all of it. I mean, I don't know about you, David, but I have a clear memory of, I must have been like sort of 14, certainly have been school age, when all my United supporting friends were watching their team win the lot. I accepted like that City, like I had a very real moment of thinking that'll never be us, and that's just how it is, and there has to be something more now, and something else that you take from all of this if your aspiration isn't to win a trophy, because that stopped being my aspiration. And then lo and behold, we essentially win the football version of the lottery, but it brings with it a load of shit as well. Mm. And if you, you sort of have to acknowledge that a lot of the shit that comes with it, like, and a lot of the stuff that we get criticized for is justified. And some of it isn't. Some of it is far too extreme, and it tries to hold us as fans accountable for things that we're not in control of. But you're sort of not engaging with it honestly if you don't think about those things, and you kind of shouldn't have to. And maybe not many other football supporters groups as a collective have to wrestle with that in quite the same way that City fans do.
Yeah, I know what you mean, because my all-time favourite City goal was scored by Mark Kennedy at Blackburn in the year 2000. And you can talk about how daft that is when you've got a player who's scored a goal to win the Champions League or the Premier League. But that day at Blackburn was the first time in my lifetime that City achieved something that they probably shouldn't have achieved. And that just sits with me. And of course, Conor, Mark Kennedy, a good old Irish legend. Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
Let's talk ahead then to the Villa game, Connor, because if the fixtures have been kind for City to have this unbeaten run in the last nine, Villa feels like a bit of a test going away to Villa Park. They've got a good run. I mean, as we record, they've not long lost 2-1 to go-ahead Eagles, so that good record has come to an end very recently. But you can't look past the upturn in form that they've had in the last few weeks either.
Yeah, I think it's all in the context of they had a really poor start. It was that they didn't score in the first five games or whatever it was. And And that was strange because I've enjoyed watching Villa over the last few seasons. Thinks Unai Emery's recruitment has been really good. He sort of brought in players who you might be aware of, but you didn't quite know all about them. And you know, he's got the best out of a lot of players. They'd be good to watch. So that was really strange at the start of the season. I'm still not convinced they've fully bounced back. I think the result of the Europa League, the go ahead Eagles results, kind of confirms that. And yeah, for City, that there have been much worse times to go to Villa Park. I think, you know, Emi Martinez was certainly had his head turned in the summer, kind of one of those games he kind of applauding the fans. It really felt like he was going to leave. Then of course that doesn't happen, and I think that's just significant of a few things. The Jadon Sancho signing, I just don't get. You know, we've seen what he can do at other clubs. He hasn't done it in years. I think maybe because they had a bit of success with Rashford in January, come in and score a few goals. I think Unai Emery was thinking he could kind of sprinkle that fairy dust over Sancho and get a similar outcome, but I don't see it so far. And it just feels, you know, look, and we have seen
just
this a
you,
lot
just
of
you wait till Sunday.
Well, no, of course I'm setting him up now for the hat trick. Exactly. Yeah. Twinkle toes. But yeah, it just sort of feels, you know, we have had this over the years where a team that's been banging on the door, trying to get in that top four, Newcastle, another good example. You get in, you have that one season, your Champions League music, and then the slump that comes off it. And it's hard to keep riding that wave. And I think that's what Villa are going through. And I think, you know, you look at some of their footballing business, the likes of bringing in Harvey Elliott, which on paper looks to be a very good signing. I commented in their game, it was at Everton, it was a 0-0 draw at least a month ago, if not more. And they were just disappointed. There was just no cut through. There was no sort of end product. And they didn't look like the Villa of last season. So, yeah, it's a shame. And, you know, I think Nottingham Forest clearly going through a similar thing where you're banging on the door, you're Champions League, you're top four, you're, oh my God, could we even be in the title race? Very hard then to go back to 0-0. In terms of point zero on the Premier League table, and then you see other teams getting ahead of you, and you think, oh, this season is already over. You know, we were trying so hard last time, we nearly got there. Now we're already 6 points behind the top four. We're never going to catch up. Blah blah blah. And I think it can be demoralizing. Momentum is without doubt the strongest thing in football, and when a team like Villa has it, it's a huge asset. But when you take that momentum away, as I think we're seeing now, they're struggling with that. So I don't think this is as bad a time for City as it could be.
You see stats pop up all the time about clubs and players, and you want to know that exact thing about City. There's an answer. Statcity.co.uk. Want to find out all of the players who played alongside club legends like David Silva, Sergio Aguero or Vincent Kompany? Or maybe you'd like to know which team found it hardest to score past Joe Hart. You can find out City's record in every competition, at every stadium, and under every manager. Just go to statcity.co.uk and browse away. That's statcity.co.uk.
Get a dollop of City nostalgia every Monday. Sign up at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
Let's get a view from Villa Park before we go further into this game. I've been speaking to Frankie Maguire from the podcast All Villa No Filler about their recent upturn in form and how they're feeling ahead of this one.
Yeah, it's unbelievable, really. I think the opening to the season, there were noises about, you know, is Unai Emery done? Is it all finished? I mean, that was coming from very extreme parts of the fan base, really. I think on the whole, most Villa fans are very level-headed about it, and, you know, and thinking that, look, this is a squad that had a real gut punch at the end of last season with what happened at Old Trafford and a difficult summer where we couldn't buy the players that we really wanted to buy because we were under UEFA restrictions and couldn't spend more than we put out. So it was just a very difficult summer, and that seemed to bleed into the start of this season. But, you know, it just felt like Villa, if they just get a win, then we should be all right. This team have been there, done it. They know how good they are. We've got a fantastic manager as well. And went and got that win against Bologna in Europe. And Europe's been a big help to us as well, because it's just some way it feels like you can go and not think about the league and just experience Europe and go and get a win against a team. It's probably not quite at the same level as we found with a few European teams. And yeah, got an important win there. Then went and got an important win in the league against Fulham. And then, you know, follow that up with Feyenoord and Burnley as well, and then Spurs at the weekend. So it just feels like that Bologna win that started it off has just built the momentum, got the confidence back, and this team have sort of remembered how good they are, and Unai Emery himself has sort of just refound that little bit of spark as well.
Yeah. Now, obviously, you play Go Ahead Eagles as well before we get to the weekend's game. So there is a potential for you to be going in and that one in with six wins in a row if that one goes well on Thursday evening. In terms of performances, how have they been recently? Because, again, like you say, at the start of the season, you'd have probably been a bit confused as to what Villa were trying to do. And now I'm wondering if the identity is kind of a bit back in the last few weeks.
Yeah, it felt like we were just so, like, particularly in the attacking third, there was just no coherence at all. And my theory on it was that losing Asensio and Rashford was a big part of that. Asensio in kind of a number 10 central role, his ability to hold the ball up, score goals, link up play, it was just world class. And replacing a player like that is difficult. Morgan Rodgers went back into that central role. Now, Rodgers, I mean, Man City fans will, you know, I assume a fair number of you will know a bit about him, but whilst he's an excellent player, he really is. I think he could go to the top. There is just a slight flaw in his game where it feels like at times it looks like he feels like he has more time on the ball than he does. And so it felt like he'd be holding onto the ball and then not laying it off quick enough, or he'd just get tackled and then his passing would go and his confidence went. And it felt like Villa's link-up play in this first four games of the season was absolutely abysmal. We just could not create a chance at all. Finally, we got that win against Bologna sort of just, and not a great performance. But I think two things have happened is that, one, the confidence has sort of worked its way back into the entire squad. But two, against Fulham, Tyrone Mings has been brilliant for us since February this year. He got injured and Pau Torres came in, and Villa now suddenly look like the team of 2 years ago when he got top four in the league. Pau Torres is just absolutely crucial to how we play and getting that ball from back to front. And another problem for us was that Tielemans got injured. So there was nobody from the back, you know, that could play the ball out, you know, as accurately and as speedily as Tielemans could or Torres. And now Torres is back. Tielemans isn't back yet, but just having Torres has been transformational. And you really saw it against Tottenham as well. Like the way he was able to play out right into that number 10, right into the forward line, bypassing the midfield. The accuracy and speed of his passing is crucial to how Villa play. It was 2 years ago and it is again now. So it feels like Torres has, I think, probably been the catalyst for Villa refinding their form and looking like a team again who should be competing for European places this season.
Yeah. Now, I saw your game against Villa at the weekend, and I mean, obviously the headlines will be taken by the winning goal, given like the sheer quality and the build-up to it. But something that struck me was you're away from home. You are holding on to a very tight lead towards the end of the game, and Tottenham didn't get a kick. There was it was so much Aston Villa taking the ball, putting it in the fridge, as Guardiola always says, and just keeping possession and doing nothing stupid. Have you noticed a maturity in this Villa side that maybe hasn't been there in previous seasons?
Absolutely. I think that if you were to criticise Aston Villa 2 years ago, well, 2 years ago and last year, you'd have said that we often take leads in games, but we seem to just switch off. It's like it's almost becomes too easy. Concede a goal and then it wakes us up. And we actually did do that against Burnley the other week when we were 2-0 up, and we should have cruised a 3 or 4-0 win and conceded a set-piece goal. And lo and behold, you know, just saw the game out. They created nothing for 15 minutes. And again, the same with Tottenham. Yeah, definitely. It has to be a maturity thing, because I think a lot of these players have just had 3 or 4 years of Unai Emery. They know what he expects, and they've all improved, you know, as a team. But I think a year ago, Villa were having a real problem conceding too many goals. It was a bit like what Liverpool are now. It's like we'd win games, but we win them 3-2, or we draw 2-2, and we just keep on conceding like silly goals. And in the end, it cost us top five last season. I think now, and probably since about February last year, Villa have just worked on that defence. That's clearly what Unai Emery said. We cannot keep conceding the goals we concede. And so we've sort of gone back to a kind of, the high line is back that we had 2 years ago, and that's probably not coincidental that Pau Torres and Konsa were doing that 2 years ago. They're now doing it in recent games. But also Villa just look like we know how to see a game out. We very rarely concede chances. We kind of just sit back, allow the opposition team to pass the ball around without really making any headway. And then the danger for them then is that Villa have the players who, once we win it back, can get a ball from back to front really rapidly. And you've got a player like Ollie Watkins who makes a lot of movement, or Daniel Marlon who likes to move around and run into space. And that then offers the counter-attack goal as well. So, I'd say there's absolutely a maturity in this team now defensively that I don't think was there until roughly about February, March this year.
Yeah. And then you kind of roll that forward into this weekend's game. It's now three visits that City haven't won at Villa Park. Drew one all a couple of years ago, two defeats in the last two. You always laugh about how, you know, City come to town and it's an easy 3 points for City. Doesn't feel that way anymore.
No, and I think Villa's record against Man City in recent years, at home at least, is reflective of how transformational Unai Emery has been. I think that for years at Aston Villa, we felt like a team that we looked at, say, a Tottenham, and you thought, like, Villa, there's no reason Villa couldn't have been that team, because I think for a long time we were in a very similar place to where they were in the Premier League. You look at our history, you know, we are a big club at the end of the day. And yes, we can't financially compete with the City's, United's and Arsenal's yet. Maybe we can in 5 or 6 years. But I think Unai Emery came into this team and finally turned us into a team that gets results against top clubs instead of somebody who just, you know, puts in a half-decent performance, but in the end just politely allows the other team to go ahead and win. And I think that under Emery, City, you know, they were the team that even when City weren't at their, you know, their you know, even in pre-takeover years, there just wasn't anything we could do against them. They always seemed to be a team that just beat us, which is bizarre. But then, we, under Unai, you know, that win we got 2 years ago with Leon Bailey's deflected goal going in, it was one of the best performances I've ever seen from an Aston Villa team.
If I'm being perfectly honest, I think that one is a much better win than the one there last season. Because when City came in December last season, City were an absolute shambles of a side. Yeah. Whereas that one in 2023, yes, they were without Rodri, but like this was a City team that would still go on to win the title that season. Yeah. And would still kind of go on to do City-like things in the second half of the season. Last season, City were a mess and Villa just took advantage of that.
Yeah, that game 2 years ago, I think it's the best performance I've ever seen from a Villa team ever, because you consider the quality of the opposition, and that was the year City were just absolutely insanely fantastic. And then last year, yeah, you could feel it last year. You felt, I think we can go on and win this. It just felt like City were there for the taking at that point. Right now, it's interesting.
Well, I was going to say this because, I mean, this is the third year in a row now where City will come to Villa Park without Rodri. And you don't want to pin everything that City do being on Rodri, but like it really does it feel like a difference maker for Villa in this, in that you know that in the midfield, maybe City might not be able to be as dominant as they would like to be.
Yeah, I mean, Rodri is just such an incredible football player. Like, people questioning why he won the Ballon d'Or. I mean, I if you watched him, I mean, there's a reason City's record was what it was with him in the team. Amazing player. And we have looked out, really, him not being available for now. It will be for three games in a row. Yeah, absolutely. A change. I mean, even for the Villa players, it must change something mentally to think he's not there. And it must make you think, There's going to be a vulnerability that is there that wouldn't be there if Rodri was around. I don't really know who's really filling that role for City right now. I've not actually been able to watch much of City just yet this season, though I caught your destruction of Wolves earlier and I saw the Tottenham game as well. But
It'll most likely be Nico Gonzalez, who is good, but he gets caught a little bit high up sometimes.
Yeah, and I think that when Villa look in their central areas, that is where we're really, really strong. Yes, Tielemans is out, but you've got McGinn, who's just a physical handful, but then you've got Onana, Kamara, who are, and I cannot rave about Kamara enough. Please, City, don't come and buy him, because he is that level. And then Lamar Bogard as well coming through, looks a super young talent as well. So it's in that area where Villa are particularly strong. And I think if Rodri was there, then you've had to overcome that. But Nico Gonzalez, whilst he's obviously a very talented player, he's still somebody who's growing and adapting to the Premier League. And it must be an area where Villa will look at and think that is somewhere we can target City for sure.
Yeah. Just very quickly on your squad for this game, because you mentioned the transfers earlier on and how the summer had gone. How are you feeling about the squad at the moment? Because looking from the outside in, for instance, like the loan sign of Jadon Sancho was a bit of an eyebrow raiser. And like it feels like it's been very much bargain basement signings. And I don't know. I don't know kind of how that's fitting together for this season.
Yeah, unfortunately, it was a crisis of a summer, really. As I said earlier, you know, we were under a UEFA restriction because we overspent. You know, various question marks about, you know, UEFA rules and what it means about competition. Slightly separate issue, but yeah, so it was a difficult summer. And I mean, at the end, we did get Harvey Elliott. We got Jadon Sancho on loan. The Sancho one is an eyebrow raiser. It makes, you know, it kind of felt right at that moment we need an injection of something, because we just lost 3-0 to Palace at home as well. And it felt like it was like the season could really drift quite quickly if we don't sort of get something. And Sancho coming in, I mean, I think my theory on Sancho is that he's going to be a European difference maker, and that in the Premier League, it's a bit of a gamble. We'll see how it goes. But I feel like in Europe, he showed last season in the Conference League for Chelsea, you know, scored in the final. He got a lot of key goals and assists in that competition. But in the Europa League, I think he could be a real difference, and that could just get a goal that gets us all the way to the final, maybe. Harvey Elliott, I think, is a fantastic player. I think Unai Emery does take his time bedding players into the team. So I think with Harvey Elliott, it's going to take a little bit of time for him to come in like it did with Tielemans. But once he clicks, I think it'll be a great signing for us. Squad-wise, yeah, it's a shame we weren't really able to, you know, add a little bit more than we probably wanted to. We've signed Evan Guessand, who, again, looks like a player who's going to need quite a while to adapt to the Premier League. I think defensively, Guessand has looked excellent, and I think he's really helped Matty Cash in that sense on the right-hand side. And so defensively, we look quite sure down that side because he's always tracking back. He makes lots of tackles. I'm surprised he's not a CDM, to be honest. I mean, going forward last year, he had a great year for Nice in Ligue 1. In the Premier League, it looks like he's just having that moment of where his first touch is a little bit like it's a first touch where he thinks he's got maybe a second more than he does. The Premier League is just so brutally quick. And I think once he gets a goal or an assist, then he'll really click. But we're just kind of waiting for that moment. And so, yeah, it is a little bit reliant on players who, you know, Asensio and Rashford came in and were ready straight away. We're relying on players who are having to take time to adapt. And so, yeah, it's challenging in that way, but at the same time, we've only lost Ramsey, really, and so we've still got a very, very experienced core group. Yeah. And hopefully that core group, with their experience of PSG and Bayern and all that last year, can help drive us on this year to compete again for Champions League places, and who knows what we can do in the Europa League.
Yeah, for sure. Well, let's get to the game then. We've got the charity bet coming up, Frankie. How do you think it's going to go, and what will be your score prediction for that?
I think two teams who must be quite high in confidence right now. I don't think we're going to stop Erling Haaland scoring. He is the Terminator. He was set back from the future. He's incredible, isn't he? So I'm going to say he scores twice. And I think Villa get two as well. So I'm going to say 2-2.
Email the show through our website, bluemoonpodcast.com.
That was Frankie Maguire. Richard, for the third year in a row, City go to Villa Park without Rodri. He was suspended a couple of years ago, obviously injured last season. We talked about Nico Gonzalez and how they're fixed without Rodri at the moment. We'll find out on Friday about whether Gonzalez is fit or not. He came off against Villarreal. I mean, the big question is, like, if he isn't fit, who the hell sits there?
It's tough, isn't it? I worry that I'm just falling back on this used to work, so would it still work? On current form and fitness, I'd be quite happy to put John Stones in that role and see how that still works, because the quality's still there. You know, he's fit and playing well, and his cliche alert, football brain won't have diminished, will it? Like, he's a clever player, John Stones. And in terms of this having become a difficult place for City to go, and you'd think, you know, Villa Park, generally a good atmosphere, maybe not so hostile that it'll be difficult for the players to play in. But certainly John Stones, with his experience, you know, if it's tough at the start, if Villa come flying out the traps, Stones in a midfield position, just there's something about that speaks to me as the perfect player to sort of help the team ride all of that out.
I just think, though, that is, there's something that warms the heart about having John Stones on the ball in a City team. It just feels right, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's calming, which, I mean, this is a whole feature for when he goes, I'm sure. But, like, to say that about John Stones, when you think of the reputation he had about a year into his time at City, and the points where we nearly could have gone. So I think that that's about the most assured you could feel if somebody on the ball in a City team is quite a thing. I absolutely love him. He's in my, easily in my top five favourite City players, I reckon, of all time. And so, yeah, maybe not my most insightful answer ever, but I'd be happy to fall back on something that has worked before, and no need to reinvent the wheel if we don't have to. When I guess part of our success at the moment is that things are just working quite steadily.
Connor, there is another side to this as well, in that the last two times City have gone there without Rodri, Villa have been absolutely flying and have basically run straight through the middle of City. But this time around, does it really matter if the middle isn't quite up to standard of up to the standard of what it normally would be? If you've got Donnarumma in at one end keeping him out and Haaland at the other end putting him in?
I think, look, you've posed that very cleverly, but I think Manchester City teams, when the defence gets exposed, when the midfield, for whatever reason, goes absent without leave, and suddenly defenders, central defenders are being turned and they've got guys on their shoulders, that I think over the years, for me as an outsider, is when City would be the most vulnerable. Mm. And that's why I think Rodri is so highly lauded, that he prevents that happening so much, that extra little layer of insulation. And sometimes he does it right on the edge of the opposition box. You know, City of a corner or something, he will cut things down. He'll take a free kick, he'll take a yellow card to ensure that there's no mad sprint for those behind him. And I was looking at the stats earlier on today. There's no doubt City defending much calmer, much, you know, the individual errors have been stamped out. I think a lot of that is just about how comfortable they feel individually. I still think this one, I mean, Kovacic is back playing again. I think he's going to come into a midfield. I always think these games, when Pep needs someone in a deeper role, he often deploys Bernardo Silva deeper.
He gets that ball in the fridge and he keeps it nice and cool.
He just keeps it moving and keeps it flowing in a bit, very like the way Zubimendi does it at Arsenal. I actually think that could be a real weapon that maybe City haven't used a lot recently because they haven't needed to with Rodri and obviously with Nico Gonzalez. I presume Rico Lewis is fit at the moment, right? I mean, he can play a role there. So it's not that he's short of options here. But to take your point about, you know, does it matter? No, it does matter. You know, it's all well and good. The City defenders having to just take care of Ollie Watkins, and maybe if it's Malin or whoever, you know, Sancho, whoever it is. But if they then also have the midfield, the McGinns and all those getting space and getting forward as well, and those City defenders have to, you know, split their brain to keep across, that's where I can see problems for Manchester City. So keeping a firm lid in the midfield, it just has to be key. And you know, as much as you like to say, let them have as many shots as they want, Donnarumma won't let in many, I don't think you'll get very far with that. Yeah. As good as he is.
As good as he is. Richard, we got Swansea as well in the midweek after. They've knocked Nottingham Forest out of the League Cup, coming from 2-0 down. But that doesn't tell the whole story, because obviously Forest have had their own issues with style of play, with new managers, all that sort of thing. I mean, this is a well-trodden path, and me and you have said it on this podcast for nigh on 17 years now. But you make too many changes and you open yourselves up to it being a banana skin. So like, you can see some rotation, but maybe not as much as people might expect.
Yeah, agreed. And just on the point about them beating Forest, by the way, I mean, the more time has gone on, the goes from looking like a great result to what a disgrace that they conceded too. But I wouldn't expect it to be. There'll be rotation, and maybe it's a chance to bring, you know, give Shirky a start and those kind of changes. When we get a chance, Marmoush, exactly. But it's not going to be the kind of rotation where they bring in the kids or, play a team of academy players. It's just not how it works, is it? And City have, although it's been a while now, relatively, City obviously and Pep have a proud record in this cup for a reason. And they won it four times in a row for a reason. Pep takes it seriously, and it might feel slightly less serious now, but I wager that's just because they haven't won it. It's not that it's meant any less to them. It's, you know, they had, you know, thinking back to like a couple of years ago, no, last season even, getting beat by Tottenham, like, it's just the worst draw City can really have in that stage of the season, Tottenham away, when they'd already, they were just slipping into that bad run. This kind of draw is perfect for City. That's not to disrespect Swansea, because of course there is a chance we could get beat, but it's a game that City should win. It's a chance to do it without having to put all of the best players out. And then suddenly you're progressing quite deep into a cup, and you've got, you're in the mix for winning it. So yeah. It's a perfect game for City. They have to go out. They have to go out and do the job too.
Got to get that three-handled beauty back at some point. Connor, the games after Swansea as well. Bournemouth at home, Dortmund at home, Liverpool at home. A tricky run, but they're all at home. And that, I mean, that could be a key thing when it comes to Guardiola's thinking. That is, that it's kind of like, at this point now, it's a great opportunity to get some players who haven't played some form.
Yeah, it's funny. I remember weeks ago, back when City were still, you know, 100% record, and a City fan said to me, they said, when we play City, and is it late November? He said, I bet you City can beat them that day to go ahead of them. And I was like, really? No way. Like, you know, I didn't see that. But it's like, they're already ahead of them. It's incredible. That Bournemouth one is tricky. Bournemouth, just that's banana skin written all over it. If that was on the South Coast, you'd be particularly worried, as you say, home advantage in City's favour. No, look, I've been really impressed with City. I thought they were going to win the Club World Cup. I thought they were going to start this season really well. I was very surprised with the few runs back end of August when things were going awry. And I'm thinking, hang on, I know there's new signings coming in, but there's so much quality here. What's going on? And I even thought in some little extra, I didn't see all the games, but some of the games I saw, I thought, you know, City were playing really well. Like, it's, you know, Ryan just seemed to have settled in, and it was just a funny thing. But you look at it now, if they beat Villa at the weekend, that's 10 unbeaten. That is a statement. That is a mentality. And this is where the monster that is Manchester City can kick in now. Get through this period. I think absolutely he'll go for me. He won't start Haaland, but he will play a team to beat Swansea, because frankly he's not going two seasons without a trophy, Pep. You know, and he doesn't care. Get the League Cup, whatever. But you don't just brush that aside. Every trophy is of extreme value this season because there wasn't one last season. So yeah, look, I fancy City to go on a bit of a run here. I can't wait to see more of Cherki. What I've seen of him, and I actually saw him play for Lyon last season. Brilliant. I saw him play for France. It was at the Nations League finals in June. He is brilliant, you know, and we really haven't seen much of him in a City shirt. So, like, get 10 games into his legs, get him playing well. I think there's a, you know, I'm not going to say Kevin De Bruyne, but, you know, there is a really talented player there that City fans still haven't seen the best of. So you put all those together, keep Haaland fit, keep him scoring the goals. I think City are in a really good position to be right up there come the festive period.
You're listening to the Blue Moon Podcast. You've made it this far, so don't give up now.
Time to test the mood in South Wales ahead of this cup game. I've been speaking to the lapsed podcasters, but persistent Swansea fans, Sam Freeman and first Alex Tomuta, about their season so far.
For the Swans, to be honest, it's been a bit of a underwhelming season. I think many have found it's been quite underwhelming. For us in particular, because we've had such an investment, and there's been, you know, everyone's heard about, you know, Snoop Dogg this, Luka Modric that, and it's all been very sort of exciting, and everyone's, you know, really, really gassed about it. But I think performance on the pitch, results on the pitch, even playing the way we've been playing on the pitch, I think a lot of people have been feeling sort of like, oof, actually, we're not in for the season we were hoping for. And then we got, I think it's QPR the week before you, then we got Norwich then on the weekend, and then obviously Man City coming down. I think everybody's sort of excited. There's a bit of a buzz for it because, you know, whenever Man City come anywhere, you know, you get the stars coming out. But performance-wise, can't see us. Can't see us having much of a chance, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, Sam, we've talked endlessly on previous episodes about other cup games between City and Swansea. There's been some crackers in the past, so there's potential there.
Definitely. I mean, like the last time, we're looking to right some wrongs, I think. the last time we were robbed, man, we were robbed in that FA Cup. I think a lot of Swans fans, I do think as well, genuinely, that if we had beaten you in that game, I think we would have stood a very, very good chance of winning the cup. And as a championship team under Graham Potter, that would have been quite something. But if buts and maybes, isn't it? You know.
Yeah. Are you feeling the same as Alex in terms of the season so far? Is there any kind of positive vibes that things could improve as the season kind of goes on? Because we are, I mean, as we speak, we are only in the end of October. There's plenty of things that can change.
Yeah, sure. I mean, like we haven't played. I mean, if you look at the table, it's not been a disaster. We are firmly mid-table. I just think some of the performances, perhaps, and it's, like Alex said, some of the football we've seen hasn't maybe lived up to perhaps the recruitment that was so boasted about in the summer, which I think, like, we brought in the likes of Inusa, who's looked sharp, but going forward, I just don't think we've shown quite enough.
There are signs, though. I think Ethan Galbraith is just... he's got the potential to light the whole club up, I think. And I think under the right manager, and that's a discussion for another day, is I think players like Galbraith can take us further. I just think there's a ceiling to perhaps where we can go under Alan Sheehan maybe at the minute. Mm. I like him and I want to like him, but I think with this squad, I think he can possibly do more. And I don't think we've seen really the signs that the football that we want to see as fans is being played, you know, to the extent we'd like it to be played this season.
Yeah, I mean, Alex, Sam mentioned the Graham Potter FA Cup tie between City and Swansea, and Swansea scored a goal in that was worthy of a sort of a Guardiola side with the build up through the thirds. How is it with like style of play at the moment? Are we anywhere near that sort of level, or is it just kind of becoming getting through games, you know, seeing what you can do, keep it tight, that sort of thing?
For a long time. At the Swans, everybody knows Swans for like Swans alone, playing football, passing style, something that Guardiola's obviously implemented at City, but then kind of changed it and adapted it to play with these inverted fullbacks, and then you're playing more direct football, and then it gets faster. And I feel like that's kind of where the Swans kind of wanted to be, and they were trying to do this sort of passing football. And I just feel like what we are trying to do now is kind of out of date. So we're kind of keeping the ball for the sake of keeping it, passing it sideways, passing it back. And then we kind of get lost in this, like, I don't really know.
I don't think we are, though. I don't think we're passing. I think we're playing differently under Sheehan.
Yeah, but I think that's because Sheehan hasn't really... He hasn't got a style.
Yeah, I agree.
And he hasn't got enough experience to develop himself, like to develop a style for himself. Yeah. So he's taken what he's had. He's like inherited this squad to an extent. He's inherited some of the spine of it, who were very used to playing under, you know, people like, you know, Luke Williams. And he's a very, you know, he's a student of that passing football, like that passing style. So I don't know. I feel like he's kind of like Sheehan's kind of caught himself in between that and then maybe trying to score more, be more direct, but then conserve the ball a bit more, keep hold of it. He's trying to, you know, I don't know. I think there needs to be, the Swans in particular, just somebody to come in and say, right, this is what we're going to do, but then also have a plan B as well, because the only plan B we've had for the last, I think, 5 years is to make plan A work, which ain't good enough.
Yeah, Sam, what do you think he'll do for this week, for this game then in particular? Because obviously you've got a team that City haven't been at the best in recent years, but they're still up there as one of the top three teams from last season. So how will he approach this one?
However they want, really. That's the answer.
I think it's like, we'll be doing some Hail Marys, I think. I mean, I just don't know. We'll see. I think there's a potential for a surprise just because no one expects us to do anything against City. I worry about our right-hand side. I think everybody worries about our right-hand side. I'm sure Josh Key is a lovely man, but he's not doing it for many of us at the minute at right back. And if Jeremy Doku plays, we watched him against Wales last week, didn't we, Al? And he had quite a bit of fun.
It was his stadium. He turned up and he did whatever he wanted to do and then went home. So.
And I think he might have even more fun if he does play next week. But
he'll have a holiday home down here now.
I'm so against normally the managers who are the type who's like, just, you know, go out and just enjoy the occasion. I hate that phrase. Next Tuesday, is it Tuesday or Wednesday? Next Wednesday, whenever the game is, just go out and enjoy it, man. Just try not to get pummeled 9-0. Like, it would just be, you know, I don't know. I'd like to see us give City a bit of a game in areas. I'd like to see the midfield. I think Ethan Galbraith, if he plays, I do think.
Can you stop talking about Ethan Galbraith? You're putting him on blast. Is it everybody? Oh, who's this Ethan Galbraith? Yeah.
Shot window on it. Yeah. Oh, what a player.
Actually, they're on a point.
that's my only concern, is if he plays well, it'll be sort of a global audience, maybe. But yeah, we'll see. I don't expect anything, so anything's a bonus, I suppose.
Yeah, you don't have to worry, Alex. Guardiola will not be listening to this, so he's not listening to this. Thinking, what do the Blue Moon lads have in store for me for some tactical advice? Whatever we can offer, we're far below what he'll listen to. Alex, what in terms of as Sam says, there it's kind of a bit of a free hit. If it is going to come to pass that you do end up knocking City out of the cup, who are going to be the players that does it? And like, is it going to be a case of getting through the game, getting to a penalty shootout, that sort of thing? Or have you got possibility that you can nick it 1-0, 2-1, something like that? Are there players in there that could be dangerous?
I think if it's going to be a case of Swansea do win in the game, it'll be won in the first half. And we'll just have to shut the shop up towards the end of the game. Even from the 45th minute onwards, I think it'll just be a case of, right, just we've got our 1-0, our 2-0, 2-1, whatever it may be. Just shut the shop up and then, you know, take whatever comes at us. I think, you know, Sam's mentioned Galbraith. He's been our shining light this season. Franco, again, just an absolute dog in the midfield. I think Vipotnik now, finally, he's found the back of the net. He's scoring, so, you know, our forward. I think, again, you know, Anous, you mentioned Anous as well, Sam did. We've got players who will, you know, create these chances. I don't think necessarily they're like intrinsically creative players. They're not players who you look at and think, oh yeah, they are going to be the ones who are going to, you know, make it happen. It's going to go through them. They're the ones who will sort of be on the receiving end. Maybe Galbraith to an extent, but I think if we're, you know, it's a bit of a stupid thing for me to say, but if we're going man for man, I think it's fair to say you've got more creative players than we do. But even players who can create something out of nothing, and we don't, you know, I know we're a championship club and I'm not expecting to be, you know, punching above our weight, you know, next Wednesday in particular. But I think you've got to be able to have them players who can just create something and just pull you out of whatever you're in. So if we can maybe catch you off, you know, off the counter, or, you know, heaven forbid we, you know, outplay you for one stretch of the game and we pinch a goal, then it'll just be a case of, right, consolidate what we've got and then see if we can just take it into 90th, and then just I'd corner flag it for 85 minutes. I wouldn't care. I honestly wouldn't be bothered at all.
If it gets the job done.
Exactly, yeah.
I think we might play with more freedom, though. I think we saw that against Forest. Because it's a cup game, and like you said, it's sort of a free hit. So there's no draws. You don't get a point. You're not taking a point home against the better side. So like, we played Southampton on the weekend. They battered us for 90 minutes, but we came away with a point. You know, I think towards the end of that game, there would have been no, you know, just go for it. And if we lose, we lose. It'll be, right, you're playing for a draw now because you're taking a point away from St. Mary's. But there's no such thing as taking a point away from a cup game. I think that is why we won that Forest game. All right, probably largely owing to Postecoglou's tactics and the way he played. But I do think there's an element of, when have we seen in the league, you know, in recent years, us come from two goals down against better opposition? It's never happened. It's never happened. And I think in the cup, there was just this sort of freedom that we played with against Forest that allowed us to play like that and get those three goals to win the game. Yeah. I think we could see, you know, maybe some more freedom and a little bit of a different mentality, because we're massive, massive underdogs and it is a free hit.
Hey, why not? Why not? And this is the point of the show now, where it's money where your mouth this time, because we've got a charity bet coming up. The sad thing is, I only have one slot on the charity bet for the pair of you, so you're going to have to thrash it out between you and come up with a scoreline. What are you going to do?
It's not a case of, you know, who. It's a case of how much, isn't it, Sam? So.
Yeah, 4-0 Swans. No. We can't bet against us, Al. Come on.
Yes, we can.
No, we can't.
Come on, Al. We're not Cyril the Swan.
Come on, Al. 1-0 Swansea.
1-0 Swansea. So you sure you don't want to go 3-0 Man City?
No, we're going to go 1-0 Swansea.
There we are. 1-0 Swansea it is, then. There you go.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Listen to it. Drink it in.
Sam and Alex, the Swansea fans. Now, we broke the duck on the charity bet on this season on the last episode. Ali Fogg's correct 2-0 prediction for the Villarreal game put 75 quid into the kitty for the Man City fans' food bank support group. All the charity bet winnings are going their way this season, and William Hill is giving us 3 £10 correct score singles on City's games. I've done the dutiful thing and delegated to everybody else so I don't have to look silly with a prediction. We've heard on that Frankie earlier on in the show that Frankie went for a 2-2 draw at Villa Park. That's 11-1 and £110 if he's right. Connor, what are you having for this?
As I've said in my answer before, I do feel confident for City in this. I will also say, you know, free tips are worth exactly what you pay for them. So take this with the biggest grain of salt. I think City are going to win 2-0 on Sunday.
If it comes in, it's 9-1 and 90 quid for the charity. Richard, over to you. What are you having?
I can't look past the fact that Villa, at the very least, usually ruffle our feathers. So I'm giving a City win, but I'm giving Villa a goal. 2-1 City.
2-1, 13-2 and 65 quid if you're right. We'll stick with you for Swansea. What are you having for the trip to South Wales?
The ruffle of feathers pun would have worked better for Swansea, wouldn't it? It would have been a pun for Swansea. It's not a pun at all for Villa.
It's not a pun at all for Villa, yeah.
City 3, Swansea 0.
13-2 again. £65 if you're right there. Connor, what are you going to say for that one?
I go on statement. I think he goes strong enough. I think the likes of Marmoush get on the score sheet. Cherki maybe swings one in. I'm going 4-0 City.
4-0 and Haaland doesn't play. That will be a headline and a half. 10-1 if you're right. 100 quid. And Sam and Alex, we heard they really deliberated but settled on a 1-0 Swansea win because, hey, why not? 28-1 and 280 quid if they are right. At least if it comes in, then there's a good chunk of money for charity. Remember, you've got to be 18 or over to gamble. Prices can change. And for information on responsible gambling, take a look at gambleaware.org. We will finish. We'll squeeze in a few listener questions. Get in touch on Blue Sky at bluemoonpodcast.com. Email contact@bluemoonpodcast.com. And as all the questions this week have come from Instagram, keep an eye on our Instagram page and respond to the story, and we'll get some questions in there. Rick got in touch to say, with Vincent Kompany extending his contract at Bayern, do you think that puts a spanner in the works for a potential Pep succession plan? Connor, I don't know about you, but I have this little feeling, for absolutely no reason whatsoever, that Guardiola might not be leaving at the end of this contract.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I think the hunger's been there. I think, you know, with a lot of things going on across a lot of things, it would have been very easy for him to just exit stage left a little bit, to not as be to the forefront. But he's come out with fighting talk, hasn't he? The press conferences I've been in, he's very much, you know, thumping the chest as he sort of makes his points. I wouldn't be so concerned about the Vincent Kompany thing. I think, you know, we've learned at this stage, you know, contracts are there to be broken in football. I think it's only good news if City fans, and I presume they would love the idea of him in the future. If Bayern are giving him a new contract, that means things are going well there. That is only good news. You know, there's so many popular City players who won't go on to be good managers elsewhere. If there's a chance of one, if the only negative is that club wants to give him longer term contracts, well, that's fine. I think as well, Kompany's always had such a strong link to Manchester, you know, not just the club, the city itself is clearly so close to his heart. So that would be a big bargaining chip for City in the future. But let's remember, he's still in, you know, when it comes to the comparing him to Pep sort of stuff, he is an infant in managerial terms. I mean, he had the little run in Belgium. He did okay initially in the Premier League, but, well, coming up to the Premier League with Burnley, then very much struggled. And a lot of talk of sticking to principles, but there's a little bit of Ange Postecoglou about that. You know, at some point, your principles have to bend to get the job done. He's gone to Bayern where, you know, with the greatest of respect, any three of us would probably get a good month of winning every game if we went there as coach. You know, they are such a powerful team. And I appreciate that as a bit of a dig at the Bundesliga, but you know what I mean? That is, you're coming into a well-oiled machine, a huge network of background and resources and what have you. The longer he's there, the more he learns. In the long term would be a much better bet, I think, for Manchester City than if, for example, Pep leaves and you get him at the start of next season.
Yeah, Richard, I would love to know your thought process if you woke up one morning and suddenly you were the Bayern Munich manager. I know, like, anxiety through the roof. I don't know how you'd deal with that.
Pass the ball to Harry Kane.
Yeah, somebody. I mean, it's not rocket science. Yeah.
Yeah. Richard, I mean, in terms of the Pep succession plan, like I said to Connor, there's something about it, about the way things are at the minute, that it feels like like Guardiola is like he should have finished at City ages ago. He's got nothing left to prove. So why is he still here? He's obviously still hungry for it.
Yeah, I think so. And I think there's no, beyond the fact that he's done a long time and he will leave at some point, like we are way, way, way past the point where you can look at any pattern of Pep's career and say, well, that probably means, like, he's done X before, so that means Y for City. Like, the only pattern, I suppose, is that he renews his contracts at City. So, like,
good news, everyone.
Yeah, it's the most reliable pattern we've got for how he acts, because he only does 3 or 4 years thing is a long, long way behind him. You never know what personal circumstances might mean for his football career. I think he does talk often about City will probably be his last club job, or he'll need a big break after that. But the thing that everybody sort of knows about Pep, like it might have changed in how it manifests, but like he's addicted, isn't he? I mean, as I suppose like all managers who have any longevity about them probably have to be, to keep putting themselves through it. And you just sort of wonder, as we seem to be, and these people who can talk about this far more eloquently than me, but as we seem to be moving to some kind of new stage of football, like whether you call that post-Pep or however you want to look at that, like the era that has been defined by Pep and his principles, and everybody either copying that or existing as a reaction to it, we seem to be moving through that and past that. And the appeal to Pep of saying, well, actually, I've got something to say about what the next era looks like as well. I mean, that must be incredibly appealing. And I think he will want to leave things in a good shape. Like I would think you have your managers like Mourinho, who they go in and pass Mourinho when he was, you know, one of the best around. Go in, do the job, doesn't matter what it looks like after, as long as you're successful when you're there. And then you've got the Fergie type stuff where it absolutely defined a generation. Everything went to pot after him, and that suddenly, how to phrase it, doesn't bring into question his legacy, but what follows after it, I feel like, becomes part of your legacy as well. Like, he got out at the right time, didn't he? And I don't think Pep, I think that would be quite unsatisfying when instead he's got this younger group of players again now who he's got a chance to really shape how they see football. As all, you know, most of his past players seem to acknowledge, their view of football is shaped by Pep's view of football. And he's got a chance to do that again and at least see City into the next stage of whatever the Premier League is going to look like. And maybe if long throws and all of that are coming back, maybe this is Pep's glorified way of showing he could always do it on a the windy nights at Stoke and all that kind of thing.
I think the good news for City is Ancelotti taking the Brazil job, because I think that's one that would have tempted him, you know, to take Brazil to a World Cup. And I'm pretty sure early in his career he had mentioned the Brazilian national job as one that he would aspire to. So in the here and now, if we all agree he's addicted to management and he wants to do it, then, you know, City is still the best equipped place in terms of the resources he'll have, the players, the buy-in, the fans, the support, the pedigree, the whole shebang. I still think at some stage in his career he will go back to Barcelona, a bit of a sort of Keegan back to Newcastle kind of vibe. I can definitely see him later on in the career having, you know, maybe if Barcelona fall a little bit in hard times and bring back in Pep to kind of revive it. I can definitely see that when he's older.
Hey, if that happens, I'm all for getting Keegan back at City then. You know, exactly. Like, swing everything back around. One very last question to squeeze in. Richard, I'll throw it to you, because Kurt's been in touch on Instagram to say, Josko Gvardiol is now wearing a headband and nobody is talking about it. That's a little bit kind of, what if Alan Shearer turns up with hair? Is there a plan in place for this? Who are City's best headband players, Kurt asks. And I sent you this last night, because I sat there, I got the question, thought, well, beyond Jack Grealish, who is there? There are some, like the Hughes to Mancini era, City were headband FC. Adebayor, yeah. Tevez.
Yeah, I mean, Tevez is the one for me in terms of shouting out quality, and not to give away any future Patreon episodes, but in terms of cult heroes who might have won a headband, I mean, in terms of absolute quality, Rolando Bianchi came to mind very quickly for me. I say I'm mind blank, but Bianchi did come to mind quickly, but I don't think he can qualify as one of the best. But I'm going to make an early shout. Future headband wearers of Manchester City. Mateo Kovacic, what's going on?
I know, it's weird, isn't it? I mean, he was when he was warming up against Everton, my mum, who sits next to me, always says, who's this coming on? Because she can't see properly on the other side of the pitch. And Kovacic was stood there, and I was like, I don't know.
It's a little bit too no country for old men for my liking. And also, I'm fuming with him for abandoning the bald community as a member myself. I didn't know it was possible to just do that, to go away injured and come back with a full head of hair. So I might have to try it if I ever get some sick leave.
I think Kevin De Bruyne did that though, didn't he? When he had that injury, he came back with some barnet. Holy moly.
Yeah, Richard, you go away and hack your legs to bits and get yourself rested up, grow some hair. But that is it for this episode of the Blue Moon Podcast. Thank you very much to my guests for this one, Richard Burns.
Thank you very much.
And Conor McNamara.
Thanks, David. Looking forward to Sunday.
We will have a clip of this week's Nostalgia episode coming up shortly. That was a brand new episode of Agree to Disagree, where Dan Burke, Dom Fowle and Adam Monk all debated topics like, was it better when City and United were title rivals? And will something good ever happen when City play Middlesbrough? The full thing is available now for Patreon members. Head over to members.bloomingpodcast.com for more information. I'll be back next week after the games with Villa and Swansea. I'll see you then.
That was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please give the show a rating and a review where you can. And don't forget, you can listen without the ads by signing up to our Patreon. You'll also get an extra episode each Monday. Here's a clip of this week's.
Fluorescent yellow has become a traditional City colour.
Yeah, it's now up there with the black and red stripes that obviously Malcolm Allison nicked off AC Milan that City won a load of trophies in the late 60s and early 70s. And the maroon as well. That's famous because that's what the team are wearing in the cup final where Burke Troutman broke his neck. So those are like the traditional change colours, which come from moments of greatness and high achievement. And this one comes from nearly making a monumental bollocks of promotion from a division they were supposed to waltz to. It was so funny the season when they had the anniversary kit and you've basically got Erling Haaland dressed up as Gareth Taylor and Kevin De Bruyne dressed as Kevin Horlock. It's just... it's featured in so many kits as well. I don't know if you remember this. That Le Coq Sportif kit on the takeover season, you know, so the Rubinho wears it. The string in the home shorts for that was fluorescent yellow. It's like, what's all that? Can you imagine trying to explain that to Rubinho, who basically thought he'd signed for Chelsea anyway? Didn't know what was going on. It's like, what's the deal with this string here, mate? Let me tell you about when Terry Cook signed on loan.
But if I remove the sentiment and look at the colour scheme and try and
it's shite.
It's like, it's something I like, but I know, I feel like I maybe shouldn't. It's like sparkling water or something.
You can listen to more of that at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast and join us again next time for another episode.